This is a recording of a live Resolution Foundation event. We hope you find it some combination of interesting or entertaining. To read the research and access the event slides referenced in this episode, please visit the events section of our website.
Thank you. Welcome back. I hope you all had time to get a tea and coffee. And thank you all for your continued attention and participation. So, yes, I'm going to introduce the second panel of today, which is going to look at spending and strategy and how the different devolved nations have prioritised their spending towards wider economic goals. We're also going to be discussing the idea of how do you measure success and prosperity, and what sort of opportunities and challenges the devolved nations have faced over the last 25 years. So I'd like to invite each of our speakers onto the stage. We're going to be hearing from David Phillips, Associate Director at the IFS. David's works on devolved and local government finance, particularly the distribution of funding, incentives and risks, and responses to those risks. He's also worked on the fiscal framework in Scotland and Wales. I'm also joined by another representative from Northern Ireland on this panel, Professor Katie Hayward, Professor of Political Sociology at Queen's University Belfast. Katie is also co-director of the Centre for International Borders Research, and her work focuses in Northern Ireland and the Republic on things like border management, EU integration, Brexit, and peace and conflict processes. And finally, also we're joined by Jonathan Tench, Director of Wellbeing, Economy and Programmes at the Future Generations Commission. He supports the team's international work and leads on private sector engagement. So thank you all very much for joining us. And a very similar setup, housekeeping-wise, to the last panel. We'll be hearing a short presentation from each of our speakers, and then there'll be an opportunity for questions and discussions at the end. So we'll start off, kick things off with you, David Phillips from the IFS. Thank you.
Great, thank you, and good afternoon. So, unusually, no slides, no charts, no tables, but there are numbers, I'm afraid. So I'm going to focus on public service spending, and I'll kick off by talking a little bit about some of the facts and figures, and then move on to why I think this kind of relates a bit to some extent, economic policy, but more generally, a sort of a different vision of the role of the state in Scotland compared to certainly England. So the first fact, Scottish public service spending is substantially higher. At the Coca Burger Band. Stop singing. Spending per person is around 25% higher than it is in England. That has sort of oscillated over time, but it's been at a similar level since devolution. Now, given the geographic, demographic and socioeconomic characteristics of Scotland, spending needs are probably higher. But I don't think you'd find any sort of person without skin in the game who thinks that public service spending needs are 25% higher in Scotland than they are in England. Now, the gap is bigger for capital spending than it is for day-to-day spending. When we looked at this in the late 2010s, it was around 45% higher for capital spending. Now, in part, that's because the Scottish Government can borrow £450 million per year for capital investment, subject to an overall cap. Now, that cap is getting closer, so the Scottish Government is going to have to cut back its borrowing to remain below that cap. And that means, if anything, in the next few years, capital spend will be cut further in Scotland than it is in the rest of the UK. So that's an important issue for public investment in Scotland going forwards. So fact one, higher spending, particularly on capital investment. Fact two, spending per person is higher on nearly all areas of public service spending, but it differs vastly between public services. So the gap currently is about 1% for health. It's 15% for public order and safety, 20% for education, 37% for transport, 45% for environmental protection, 76% for recreation and culture. So higher spending across the board, but very different degrees of extra spending across services. Now for economic development economic support, the figures recently are affected by COVID, which is classified under that area of spending. But if you look back at 2018-19, the last figures from before COVID is around 50% higher in Scotland and England. That's actually higher than in Wales and Northern Ireland too, substantially poorer than Scotland. Okay, So, fact three. The changes in spending on different services have been quite different over time in Scotland. Not just the levels, that's not just something that's been the same since devolution, it has changed over time. So health spending in Scotland was 22% higher than in England at the point of devolution. It was around 10% higher by the end of the 2000s, 3% higher by the end of the 2010s, and I said about 1% higher now. So there's been this kind of convergence in health spending in Scotland to the sort of English level. Now, part of that perhaps reflects definitions and policy choices in the sort of related areas. So social care, adult social care spending, that is higher in Scotland, and it has got increasingly higher. It was 27% higher at the point of devolution. It's now 47% higher. But even if you kind of combine those two figures and you look at health and social care together, it's gone from 23% down to 7% higher over the last 24, 25 years or so. That's quite a big change over time. Now, that's not because, as I said, spending in Scotland's converged to English levels. Across the board, spending is slightly lower, perhaps, but, you know, it's been about 25% to 30% across the period since devolution. Now, that means Scottish Government's been spending more on other areas of spending. And the biggest such area is education. And this is in spite of the share of young people in Scotland falling compared to England. Now, part of this relates to higher education, where, of course, Scotland has free tuition. And part of that then relates to the kind of accounting treatments of sort of tuition loans that are written off, which are not counted as education spending in England, versus the government spending on free tuition in Scotland, which is counted. But that's only part of the story. It's not just higher education, that's that sort of statistical issue. Recent years have also seen a big increase in school spending in Scotland compared to England. So by 2021-22, we estimate spending on schools in Scotland was 25% per person or per pupil higher than in England for those aged 3 to 18. It was only 4% in 2009-10. So there's been this big shift towards education away from health in terms of the Scottish Government's budget. Transport spending is relatively higher than the outset of the devolution, although not as high as it was in the sort of late 2000s, early 2010s. Recreation and culture spending has increased, so has agriculture and rural affairs spending. So at a very high level, compared to England, there's been this shift in spending away from healthcare towards those sort of services that are more traditionally thought about as being related to economic development, education, transport, and then support for particular areas of the economy. Now, I don't want to overplay this. I don't think this really was about economic policy per se. I think there were other factors underlying this. But I think it is worth noting. Now, if we look at policies rather than just spending, I think we find many examples of devolution in action. There was a question earlier about, has devolution not mattered? Well, I think it really has mattered, not just because of these big level sort of changes in spending, but also because the sort of minutiae of the policy changes as well. Now, I won't give a sort of comprehensive list of how I think policies in Scotland have differed compared to England or Wales. But I will say one sort of key thing on this. If you look at the policies the Scottish Government has been pursuing, and to a greater or less extent, while the opposition parties have been also supporting, whether in Parliament or putting in their manifestos, I think there is a Scottish model of the state and of economic development, which increasingly differs from England. So on the public service or benefits in kind side, this model provides a wider range of free universal services that in England are often means tested. So things like higher education, personal care, prescriptions, but not just those, young people's bus travel. And more generally, transport services are much more subsidised in Scotland than they are in the rest of the UK. And that's not just about sort of the geography. Now, the main beneficiaries of this universalist approach compared to a means-tested approach are middle and upper income families. But if you look at the other side, the tax and benefits, whilst there's a more universalist approach to public services and benefits in kind, there's a more redistributive sort of approach on tax and benefits. As Emma was saying earlier, there's quite big increases in income tax on higher earners. There's been some more modest, much more modest changes to council tax. There's also the Scottish Child Payment and a range of other benefits changes as well. Now, the overall effect of all these is to make it, you know, quite more progressive on the tax and benefits side, particularly for families with children. So I think there's this model of a state that does more for everyone in terms of public services and does more redistribution in terms of tax and benefits. And that is something that I think is signed up pretty much across the board to varying extents. The Conservatives in Scotland less so than, say, the SNP and Labour, but in the last election, 2021, even the Conservative manifesto was pushing further in this direction. Now, it's not clear to me that this model will survive a likely future funding squeeze. I said it's been about 25 to 30% extra funding in Scotland compared to the rest of, or compared to England for the last 25 years. The Barnett formula probably is now going to start squeezing Scotland. Now, the Scottish Government has hinted that as this happens, it will take, you know, there's three choices it could take, really. One is it could try to salami slice each service. Two, it could put up taxes further. Or three, it could try to hone in and maybe make some of its more universal policies more targeted. The what's called the MTFS, medium-term fiscal strategy, suggests maybe some of all of these, but it could be a bit of a move away from a universalist approach with lots of references to targeted spending in the MTFS. Now, how does this relate to economic policy? Well, I don't think the economy has been the driving force behind this sort of Scottish model of the state. I think one simple factor is money. In the 2000s and the 2010s, Scottish government had more money to spend. At that stage, it didn't have benefits policy, it didn't have tax policy. What can it do? It can spend more on public services. But I think it's not just more money. I think it also sort of reflects a slightly broader view of citizens' rights and the role of the state than in the rest of the UK. Something sort of akin to specific egalitarianism, as economists call it. So basically the idea that certain services should be available for all citizens, irrespective of the ability to pay. And I think clearly a big motivation of the more recent tax benefit changes has been the sort of focus on child poverty in particular, but inequality more generally. So whilst I think this is not really about economic policy, I think it does relate to economic policy. Because I think the Scottish Government sees this model as a different, or part of a different approach to growing the economy and making Scotland an attractive place for people to live. And Emma mentioned this as well. So we saw last week newer HMRC analysis, which on its own suggested there was a bit of a response in migration when Scotland first introduced its income tax policies. But there was a separate paper in there which showed that both in Scotland and Wales, there's been growing net migration, including of higher earners, into these countries. Now, how that relates to policy is really uncertain. It looks like it's a kind of common factor affecting certainly Scotland and Wales, and it does seem to kind of line up with the timing of the pandemic. But in its response, the Scottish Government, it focused on the idea that, well, look, we shouldn't focus too much on tax and how that's affecting people. We should look at these overall trends and look at this, how this relates to our public service offers, that we have a better place to live if you're middle or higher income because you get free prescriptions, you get free tuition, you get these free services. So I think the Scottish Government is rather trying to adapt a different economic policy through its public service offering. So rather than seeing low taxes as sort of the route to attracting people and to sort of grow the supply side of the economy, it is seeing public services and the offering of greater investment as a sort of key competitive advantage. Now, I don't think we'll ever know with any real confidence whether this is more effective than the tax policy, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't try. And I think there are increasingly big changes in certain areas of policy. I think tax and benefit policy is one that was mentioned already. And I think education spending and policy is another one where in recent years, Scottish performance has been pretty poor. This big boost in spending might start to feed through to results. If it does, that's something that we should know about. So I think whilst we'll never know for sure, actually understanding more about the changes in tax and benefit policy and education spending policy should be really important focuses for sort of future analysis of Scotland's policy mix. And with that, I'll end.
Here, let me take that one. That's okay. Thank you very much, David. And I'm very impressed that there were no slides and yet lots of figures. So great, great presentation. I'll now hand over to Professor Katie Hayward.
Thank you very much, Clodagh. Good morning, everybody. Thanks to PolicyWise and Resolution Foundation for the invitation. It's a great honour to be representing Northern Ireland alongside Clodagh. As Clodagh mentioned, I've done a lot of work that's very interdisciplinary, but one thing I can't fake is being an economist, let alone an expert on public spending. So I won't do that. But what I will do is set context for Northern Ireland and in particular diagnose the core of the problem. A quarter of a century ago, the conditions in which devolution was restored to Northern Ireland, bearing in mind it had its own government for 50 years before direct rule was imposed in 72, were not the ones from which anyone would have chosen to build an economy. 30 years of violent conflict had left their mark in terms of infrastructure, investment and labour force, let alone in the legacy of the health service and public services, including policing, of course. Nevertheless, there was an optimism with the 98 Good Friday Belfast Agreement and a determination for normality. When the Northern Ireland Life and Times survey asked people in 98 what the new assembly should prioritise, the answers were overwhelmingly clear: the health service and the economy. Constitutional matters, even those of rights and equalities, were lower down the list. 25 years on, we asked the same questions, and the answers remain the same: health and the cost of living. We also posed the question to 16-year-olds: what would make Northern Ireland a good place to live? Their top answers were probably the same as any young person in the UK or Ireland: low cost of living, strong economy, and a good job. Second in the priority list, support services for mental health and well-being. This was placed even more highly than a stable political system and peace process. So it's particularly to our shame that Northern Ireland is not delivering on any of these priorities, no more for this generation than the ones who endured the Troubles. Why is this the case? The simple answer is that devolution in Northern Ireland has not been established or designed to run as if to address those priorities. The focus at the start was addressing a core dysfunction, namely its awkward, contested existence, and we've not got much further beyond that. This is not to say there haven't been brilliant entrepreneurs, smart civil servants, or responsible politicians, but there are structural and habitual problems that have remained unaddressed. Indeed, these flaws have been exacerbated, not abated, by the management of devolution by both Westminster and Stormont. Northern Ireland is governed on a very different basis to the rest of the UK, namely, fundamentally, the notion that it's lucky to have a government at all, and that this government stands or falls on the recognition of identity, not on the exercise of democratic responsibility. The larger parties are guaranteed a place in the executive. In this sense, measurements of performance of MLAs are valid primarily as performance of identity stances rather than as policymakers or decision makers. What is worse, however, and this is the core of my argument, is that the UK government has incentivised and rewarded identity performances. I'll come back to this. And so, unsurprisingly, Northern Ireland is in a poor condition. To be precise, as the Independent Fiscal Commission put it in 22, Northern Ireland is significantly poorer than the UK as a whole. National income per head is about 25% lower than that of the UK, and even lower when compared to the Republic of Ireland, which is a valid comparison to make. Northern Ireland's in the bottom three UK regions for weekly median earnings, consistently the bottom region in the UK on economic activity, and in the bottom two with the North East on employment rate. Tax revenues per person are 25% lower, and the executive has decided to forego substantial amounts of revenue had it matched policy in other parts of the UK. Meanwhile, public spending is about 20% higher on a per person basis than spending in the UK as a whole. 90% of public spending is from the block grant of 14.8 million. So there's a very large notional fiscal deficit, and one that's set to grow. And the problems are growing as well. To get an impression of these, just take a look at the headlines of recent reports of the Audit Office of Northern Ireland. On water infrastructure, a lack of capacity has meant development of applications in 100 areas can't be approved or are subject to restrictions. On water quality, less than a third of Northern Ireland's rivers had good ecological status. Only 14% of its lakes have good ecological status, which is down from 24% in 2015. On waiting lists, infamously, the total numbers waiting either for an initial outpatient appointment, inpatient treatment, or a diagnostic test have risen by 185% since 2014. So it's now 0.7 million patients on a list out of a population of 1.9 million. And on child poverty, around one in five children in Northern Ireland are living in relative poverty, with little sustained reduction in levels over the last 8 years. Notably, when an Opposition Day motion was put forward by the SDLP in the Assembly earlier this month to address the impact of the two-child limit on universal credit, it was watered down by the executive parties, who took pains to say it was a UK government policy they didn't agree with, and that the UK government hadn't given them enough money to address it. But of course, when problems aren't being addressed, they're actively getting worse and compounding and contributing to further difficulties, particularly for the younger generation. Northern Ireland's devolved institutions haven't functioned properly for 40% of the past quarter century. And for its part, the UK government has used Northern Ireland's crippled economic conditions in ways more akin to moral blackmail than democratic care. For example, when civil servants were given powers to govern Northern Ireland in the absence of an executive and assembly as a result of the recent DUP veto, they were charged with making severe budget cuts. Jane Brady, as head of the civil service, made the unprecedented step of speaking publicly about the long-term harm being caused. The answer came back, if you want to fix it, tell your politicians to get back into government. Sure enough, when the Safeguarding the Union deal was made earlier this year to persuade the DUP back into power sharing, it came along with a big whack of money, 3.3 billion, on top of the block grant. A similar situation occurred a few years ago when the DUP secured money from the government in exchange for its confidence and supply arrangement with May's Conservative Party. Though to be fair, this was probably the best thing to come out of that particular deal. What this shows is that the budget for Northern Ireland was inadequate, and we know it. But the additions are made on the basis of political expediency and incentivising that identity performance. Northern Ireland has no dearth of opportunities. It has a wealth of potential and proposals, including from the aforementioned Fiscal Commission, which recommends some fiscal devolution as a means of encouraging more accountable government. But evidence since the most recent restoration of the executive indicates that neither the UK government nor the executive think enough of Northern Ireland to do anything other than blame each other for the current poor state of affairs. Thank you.
Thank you, Kitty. And now I'll hand over to Jonathan Tench.
Thank you. I can see the First Minister, former First Minister of Wales, has arrived just in time for me to be the warmer pack in terms of what Wales is doing around well-being. So what I wanted to talk to you about is three things, really, just to spell out the Well-being of Future Generations Act in Wales as a way that Wales is trying to do things differently. To talk a little bit about its impact and then talk about some of the challenges and opportunities going forward. We've had lots of Welsh language lessons already today, so Future Generations in Welsh is Cenedlaethau'r Dyfodol, so that's my contribution, and I'm sure Mark will continue the lessons. So just on the Wellbeing of Future Generations Act, so this is a landmark piece of legislation that came in 2015. Wales became the first country to put the UN Sustainable Development Goals into law. And coupled with a large public consultation kind of exercise, Wales established seven well-being goals that would be at the forefront of how we make policies in Wales. So we have a goal around a prosperous Wales, which does not include GDP growth. Goals around a resilience Wales, around how we enhance nature, a healthier Wales, a more equal Wales, a Wales of cohesive communities, a thriving Welsh language and culture, and a globally responsible Wales. So these seven well-being goals have been put into law. So there's a legal duty on Welsh ministers and the entire public system, public sector system in Wales, to work towards these well-being goals. They're backed up by 50 well-being indicators, which again does not include GDP growth, as a way of looking at, well, how are we really doing and making progress as a country that isn't about economic growth, but is about the well-being of people and planet. The duties on the public sector in Wales are some that in Scotland there is legislation looking at how they can adopt this legal duty on public bodies to develop well-being plans. And we have a collective duty around our well-being plans in Wales as well. So a local authority will develop its well-being proposals, so its plan on how to work towards these seven national well-being goals. But we'll also do that in a collective manner as well. So we'll work with the health bodies, the fire authorities, and others in terms of developing their well-being plans. And then we have an accountability role that the legislation has set up as well. So I work for Derek Walker, the Future Generations Commissioner for Wales, and our role is to promote the Wellbeing of Future Generations Act and to hold Wales to account for how we're doing. So moving on then to the impact of the legislation, it's really become a key cornerstone of how policy is being made in Wales. So if you have a look at the Welsh Government's economic mission, if you have a look at the National Development Plan for Wales, its spatial plan. If you have a look at its latest Agriculture Act, the first Agriculture Act for Wales passed last year, you can see that the seven wellbeing goals are at the heart of how Wales is building its policies. Just a quick snapshot of how we're doing in terms of these 50 national wellbeing indicators. Biodiversity is a huge challenge. We have seen a huge decline in that over many decades. That decline is stabilising slightly, but we are still, like the rest of the UK, extremely nature depleted. And there are lots of efforts by Welsh Government and others to address that and look at how we can protect and enhance nature. We measure the real living wage. We're at 68% in Wales. It's hovered at around that level for a number of years. And we're an SME economy, which is many of the reasons why we're not making as much progress there maybe as other parts of the UK. Things that are going really well, the recycling rate in Wales. So we're the third best recyclers in the world, behind only Germany and South Korea. And there's been a real effort at bringing together local and national efforts around recycling. And there's a huge focus on a circular economy in Wales as well. It's fair to say that the pandemic and the cost of living crisis has proved hugely challenging in terms of household income and poverty levels in the UK. One area that I wanted to just mention in terms of the impact of this legislation is around transport policy. What you can really see there is this shift in terms of making a transport policy work for future generations. So before the legislation, around 2/3 of capital spending on transport was for roads, for car users, and now it's only 1/3. And what you've seen is this huge investment in public transport as a result of that. If you're looking for a rail project that has gone very well in the UK, look at the South Wales Metro, which has had £1 billion of investment. But it's fantastic that Mark Drakeford is here as well. So he took a huge decision in 2019 around the extension of the M4 motorway in Wales. So if you're looking at, is this country serious about doing things differently? That M4 relief road, of course, the business lobby wanted it to go ahead. But the decision was made that the environmental, the health, the social consequences of extending the M4 motorway did not outweigh the did outweigh the economic benefits. And so this justification was put forward not to move ahead with that policy because of the impact on future generations. Just in terms of some of the challenges and opportunities moving forward, this is a huge new way of doing things to get everyone to work together around seven wellbeing goals. Change is really hard, and that culture and that leadership shift is very challenging, particularly down at the local level. We've had 10 years now of this legislation, but we've had decades of just pursuing economic growth at all costs in the past. So this change is taking time. It's fair to say that there's a lot of public opposition as well, which is hugely challenging for our policymakers as they develop ambitious policies for what to do. What Wales is trying to do in terms of farming subsidies, I think, is far more ambitious than many other parts of the UK, and that's caused huge challenges in terms of convincing farmers to look at how they can protect and enhance nature as a result of farm payments. But there's some a scope, I think, for some resolution there. Even the farmers' unions in Wales are agreeing that we need to take action around climate change. And 20 miles per hour has been hugely challenging as well. So these are a real kind of challenges. But what you can see in Wales as a result of this legislation and lots of political leadership is that Wales is really pushing ahead and trying to really shift things. I just want to talk quickly about some of the opportunities. I read recently in The Economist, they came down to Wales, which was nice of them to do, and they talked about how Welsh policymakers are more interested in copying what's going on in Venezuela than England. I have to say, nothing could be further from the truth. There's a huge amount that Wales is learning from what's going on in the rest of England, devolved bits, but also local authorities. Just as an example, we've been learning a lot from the Preston model around the foundational economy. So since 2018, Welsh Government has been pursuing that as a key plank of its economic policy. It's often called the everyday economy. Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves have been using that term, maybe less so in the last couple of years. But it's about how do you keep the local pound spent locally. And I think there's a huge amount as well that, that Wales can learn from not only what Preston has been doing around kind of localising procurement spend, but Preston has also been looking at the types of businesses to invest in. So how do you invest in social enterprise with your public contracts? And then looking at the kind of finance models that are needed. And so there's a huge amount that I think Wales can learn from that. In Scotland, they call foundational economy community wealth building, and they're consulting on legislation around that, which is about putting a requirement on public bodies to spend locally. So there's a huge amount to learn. Wales and Scotland are part of the Wellbeing Government Alliance that are looking at how do we move beyond GDP growth. So I think a key part of the opportunities is learning from other devolved administrations around wellbeing. So thank you very much.
Great, so now we've got plenty of time for some questions. David, I'm going to kick off with you first because something that struck me whenever you were talking about potential options against a challenging public spending picture was this idea of salami slicing across the board, which is something that, you know, is certainly happening in Northern Ireland, as you heard Katie mentioning a few of our areas which have been facing really troubling headlines. Could you argue, and yes, I'm going to tie back into the previous panel on taxes and benefits, but there's an obvious overlap there. You know, is that inevitable unless there are more difficult political decisions taken, unless there is more political leadership?
Is my microphone working yet?
No. Would I can give you this one here. You can take that down with you.
Great. So is it inevitable you have a salami slice? I don't think it's inevitable. But I think
in the absence of further action.
Well, in the absence of further action, yes. That's by the action of what's called the Barnett Formula, which is underlying the funding for Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. And I said over the last 25 years, due to a combination of factors, actually, one of the kind of key features of the Barnett Formula hasn't operated. And that key feature of the Barnett Formula is called the Barnett Squeeze. Because what the Barnett Formula does is it takes the funding you have in the last year and adds on the amount equivalent to the population share of the funding change in England. So if you start off with a higher than population funding share, over time, the funding formula should sort of bring you down towards the English levels. Now, that hasn't happened in Scotland and Wales and Northern Ireland, really, until very recently, in the case of Northern Ireland, for several factors. But unless those factors are repeated, that squeeze starts to operate. So at the moment, I said Scotland gets about 25% more per person to spend. In the next 15 to 20 years, that could fall to about 15% more per person to spend, which is still more, but is a much smaller gap. And that's why I think, you know, you would need to have that sort of difficult decisions made. Either you need to just kind of like cut back service provision. If you kind of try to salami slice, you know, you see sort of a slow degradation across services. Or you need to prioritise. And one way to prioritise, and I said, this is what's in the MTFS. It says, you know, with more difficult fiscal environment ahead, we need to think about more targeted approaches. Is that the Scottish Government signalling that some of these more universalist sort of type things, they're being thought about? Last but not least is tax. And we've already seen tax increases in Scotland compared to the rest of the UK. I think the rest of the UK will be putting up taxes in the future. You asked that in the last panel, or it was one of the questions, you know, should England be putting up taxes? I think there's a question about the size of the state, what you think. But again, unless you do just kind of, you know, cut back on kind of a range of services, taxes are heading one way, heading up. But in Scotland, I think they'd need to head up even more, given that Barnett squeeze, unless you make some difficult decisions, whether that is just to kind of cut back across the board or to focus the resources on sort of those objectives that the Scottish Government has highlighted. So, you know, sustainability, poverty reduction, and so on. And I think the ones that you'd be looking at naturally, if you're looking at poverty reduction, would be shifting funding on education from sort of upper ages, higher education, more down towards lower ages. We've already seen a bit of that happening in Scotland with big increases in funding for childcare and a squeeze on resources for teaching in universities. But the next question is, does free higher education survive for the next 20 years in Scotland?
We've had a question here for Katie. Katie, what would you propose for taking the focus off the constitution and shifting it towards things like health and jobs? I know you mentioned that in your presentation that, you know, you could argue that the decisions that have been taken in Northern Ireland maybe aren't being made for the right reasons.
Yes, so I think the report of the Independent Fiscal Commission from 22 was very serious and probably the most substantial set of proposals we have for moving towards more normal, accountable government. So devolving some, you mentioned it earlier as well, some responsibilities with respect to income tax, maybe following the Scottish model, potentially, possibly, if not that far, then the Welsh model, then devolving corporation tax has been promised, but actually hasn't been done yet, and other areas of responsibility. I think, if I'd be really honest with you, I think all of this should come together. I can't see us moving towards that yet. And I think all this should come together with a so-called revision of the Good Friday Belfast Agreement, which the Northern Ireland Affairs Committee in Westminster has recommended, although the DUP had its alternative minority report to that. And we know, obviously, the DUP and Sinn Féin would be very resistant to a significant overhaul. But I think all of this comes together. So 25 years on, we are in a different place. We do have a different generation. A third of our population have been born post Good Friday Belfast Agreement. And I think there's a very severe risk of things getting considerably worse with an entrenchment of strong unionism and rising expectations of Irish unification. As we've been reminded recently with a recent slightly controversial paper from two economists in Dublin, the cost of unification will be very much in the mix, and this is becoming a murky debate. And I think the reassessment of Northern Ireland qua Northern Ireland as an entity needs to take place altogether. So some, possibly maybe even with a referendum on reform of the agreement, what we want from our functioning institutions for the next 10 years, let's just put it that way. And then with that, bring some of those reforms that the Fiscal Commission recommended. Set a kind of transition period, if you like, although you probably couldn't call it that.
Not another transition period, Kitty.
But that would be, I think, like, if we're serious, like, Ireland doesn't want a basket case, the UK doesn't need a basket case, Northern Ireland needs some serious reform politically and economically, and I think putting those two together could actually be the best way of managing it.
We've had another question here. How much scope does devolution provide for a different economic strategy versus tinkering with a UK-wide one? Jonathan, have you any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, a great question.
I think definitely economic policy is being viewed differently in Wales as a result of the Wellbeing of Future Generations Act. So calling into question, you know, is it all about economic growth that we're trying to do, or actually is it about economic growth serving well-being of people and planet? Definitely economic policy is being viewed very differently. When I look at the growth mantra of what happens around UK economic debates, in Wales you see conversations about growth for kind of future generations, and in fact the two leadership manifestos for the race to become the new First Minister in Wales, there actually wasn't much between them at all in terms of looking at economic growth to serve sustainable development. So definitely a clear sort of new angle being taken in Wales around economic development policy. I do see, though, the tension of, in Welsh economic development thinking, you've got on the one hand this push for foundational economy and circular economy, particularly with circular economy, you know, let's produce and consume less things. But then on the other hand, you've also got, you know, a business strategy around innovation and kind of growing new companies. And so I think it's very interesting that we have that tension there between the traditional and the new way of kind of thinking. And probably that's the way it has to be, as you sort of try and shift from a GDP growth model, you know, at all costs, towards a new way of thinking about the economy. So that tension is quite interesting to me in terms of how that will develop over time.
Yeah, I mean, I can't help but look at this with my Northern Irish hat on. And, you know, one of the stats that Katie had mentioned, which is always quite stark, is, you know, that 90% of our funding for public services comes from the block grant. So really, you know, and again, it ties into our previous panel, without, when you're kind of fiscal levers are so limited, surely it really only is ever tinkering around the edges, you know, in terms of the restrictions that maybe the executive, for example, would have when it comes to trying to come up with its own economic strategy. It probably, you could argue, some may argue, it would need more powers in order to do that, to make a difference.
Yeah, so but again, you come back to the tension between the political and the economic. So you saw this in the Safeguarding the Union deal, which is about Northern Ireland's post-Brexit position, which shows the limits of a UK-wide strategy, right? Northern Ireland's position is so distinctly different now. But the potential opportunities from that distinct position were, in some ways, disparaged, if not undermined, yeah, by those Safeguarding the Union deal. So instead of, so corporation tax is there as a, you know, something that unions even recognise Northern Ireland should be better aligned with the Republic of Ireland on, but downplaying the all-Ireland economy and cross-border trade, which is the only thing that's growing, is just a real pity.
Yeah.
There's a lot of opportunities in that Safeguarding the Union deal with regards to all UK internal market and all UK-wide economic development, but Wales and Scotland aren't written into that. So that East-West Council, for the moment, it seems, is Northern Ireland and Westminster. So I think fundamentally we need a new approach to, a more respectful approach to devolution itself, in order to allow the necessary flexibilities and opportunities to be grasped by the various parts of the UK to be realised.
Yeah.
I might come in as well. So I think, reflecting on what Emma said earlier, it is important to recognise that, you know, many levers are held at the UK government level, but actually we think that for the long term, what matters more for the economy is not a sort of, macro framework matters, but it's not sort of the demand side, it's the supply side of the economy. And many of the kind of key levers on the supply side do vest with devolved governments as it stands. So productivity, one of the key drivers of that is skills and education. And skills and education have been devolved since 1999 to Wales and Northern Ireland. So I think it's important to kind of actually look at, you know, what impacts are devolved policies having on skills. So in Scotland, actually quite a disappointing kind of story during the kind of 2010s when it came to sort of school standards, has this kind of big injection of money from about 2016 onwards, is that starting to kind of feed through and lead into better results? Quite different higher education policy choices in Scotland compared to the rest of the UK and, say, Wales. So in Scotland, the way the kind of higher education system works is it's quite a strong encouragement to stay in Scotland. You have free tuition. If you stay in Scotland, you don't if you go in the rest of the UK. How does that affect where people end up? Does that have an impact on the economy? You've got planning and, say, land use, where not only is local taxation, but also planning policy is devolved. And we know that the UK has some of the sort of biggest constraints on development. Some colleagues have been recently looking at what's called the elasticity of supply of housing from changes in prices. For every kind of like percent change in house prices in the UK, housing supply responds less than half as much as in the US. That's an area where, you know, that's under devolved government. So I think we need to recognise that, you know, they are, a lot of powers are still centralised. And of course, you know, devolved governments have a right to say, look, this is holding us back. If we had more powers in this area, it could help us. But actually also focus on the areas where they do have powers, where certainly on land and land taxation, I'd say they've been timid. On education, I think the jury's out on whether some of the most recent changes are going to be beneficial. But certainly in the 2010s, the direction was very much in the wrong direction when it came to outcomes, at least, where both Scotland and Wales are increasingly falling behind England.
We've had a question for you, David. It says, the debate last week was about the impact of increased defence spending on other public services. Could David expand on what it could mean for Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland? How protected are they?
Well, it sort of depends on what the UK government would do sort of in the next spending review. So the current government, when it announced this 2.5% of GDP target for defence, didn't announce any further changes in the overall spending envelopes. The overall spending envelope is a 1% increase per year in funding public services in the next parliament. Now, when you take account of plans for health, when you take account of childcare reforms, when you take account of now defence, what that can mean for unprotected services is about 3 to 4% per person per year cuts in funding. Now, translate this all into what it means for Wales, Scotland, Northern Ireland. It looks like it could mean increases for those countries of about 1% a year in the overall funding from the UK government. That's because they get a kind of combination of the changes for the various departments through the Barnett formula. So with health coming up a lot, they get money from that. Other areas being cut back, that cuts back. But with an overall envelope fixed, more money for something that's not at all devolved, defence, means less for things that are. So that would negatively impact the funding for Wales, Scotland, Northern Ireland. I think the real question is, you know, what will the next government do to public service spending? I think this sort of 1% limits have been penciled in currently. I wouldn't treat that with any real confidence. I think what you've seen with spending reviews over the last kind of 10 years or so is that when governments are forced to make the tough decisions about not just sort of hypothetical cuts to some services, but real cuts to some services, they tend to find some additional money to top it up. Mm. Will they find much money to top it up? I don't think that much. I think it will be difficult. But I think until the next election, until after the election, we won't have a clear idea about exactly how much money is available for services in England, let alone Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland.
Yeah, we've had a question for Jonathan. Could Wales make the real voluntary living wage a legal minimum wage? And would that be desirable if it was possible within the devolved powers?
Probably a question for the Resolution Foundation. I would just say what I said earlier around the progress of the real living wage. I haven't looked at this in detail, but my sense is with us being an SME economy, this is one of the challenges that we're facing around that. Something I think that is very interesting, I know I'm meant to be talking about Wales and I've talked about Preston quite a lot, but what I really like about what Preston have done is not just looking at how do we keep spend local, but they've been looking at how to do a real campaign around the real living wage there. And what I'm really interested in Wales is whether we can really look at, around our local authorities and our regional economic strategies, how can we both be promoting kind of spending within Wales, but also looking at making sure that in all of these kind of contracts that we've got the real living wage kind of, you know, at the centre of what kind of good local economic strategies would be. So I'm not quite answering the question, but I'm sure Resolution Foundation can help on that.
We've actually had a couple of Welsh-specific questions, which I'll stick with you. Is there any evidence that the Welsh Wellbeing Act has increased the rate at which wellbeing grows?
Yeah, I would say that transport example, to me, is the clearest example of a policy area being fundamentally transformed and turned on its head. And the justification used by Welsh ministers around changes in the way that we do transport, shifting out of cars to public transport, has been entirely about future generations. So when you go and have a look at the Senedd debates around these policy issues, you can see we're doing this for future generations at the heart of those debates. So we have these 50 wellbeing indicators that help us measure how we're doing. They get reported on every year. It's a pretty mixed bag in terms of how we're doing. So it's that, you know, as I mentioned, household income, poverty levels have been really hit by the pandemic and the cost of living crisis. But you can also see some real concerted action and some bright spots around kind of recycling, around some other areas as well. So, we're 10 years into this legislation. That's against decades of doing things the other way. So a bit like devolution, there's obviously a bit more kind of ground to go around looking at these real improvements for kind of people's well-being. Has the legislation made everything okay in Wales? No. But do we have a serious plan about meeting the needs of current and future generations and making that the Welsh national mission? Yes. So I've got a lot of hope in what we can do in future.
Thank you. We've got a question here that I'll put to each of you about the respective regions. So it says, in Denmark, people are mostly happy to pay high taxes because they benefit from excellent universal public services. In England, more and more people want taxes to go up to prevent public services from falling off a cliff. Are public attitudes in the three devolved nations closer to Denmark or England? Katie, I mean, whenever, like, the unfortunately, in Northern Ireland, we're a little bit numb to seeing these really bleak headlines. We know our waiting lists are the worst. We know our water quality is, you know, appalling. You know, but similarly, you know, what would your take be on this? Mm.
So I'm going to share some information that shouldn't be divulged anywhere else.
He'll stay with us and the people watching the online at home.
No, well, in the Northern Ireland Life and Times survey, I'm involved in setting the political attitudes modules. And we always ask the same questions, obviously, to allow the time series, but we get a chance to ask a couple of different questions every year. And this past one, we asked basically sort of left-right questions because we wanted to measure Northern Ireland on a similar basis to the way that other people in the UK get measured. And on this question in relation to public spending, they, and we're not releasing the results officially until May, but they do, you know, they are more left-wing, like they would like to pay higher taxes and see for the benefit of public services. On other matters, though, possibly unsurprisingly, they're more conservative, but on this, they would generally be towards the Denmark side.
David, what about Scotland?
So I should first say I'm not an expert on public opinion, but the one thing I do know is that traditionally the kind of finding was that if you asked people on sort of attitudes in sort of social attitude surveys, attitudes about the size of the state, the role of the state, Scotland and England actually didn't differ all that much historically. Scottish politics tended to kind of tend towards a bit more of the left. Although that's only really since kind of the 1960s. Look back to the 50s, Scotland was sort of actually slightly more to the, you know, Conservatives did very well in the 1950s in Scotland. But, you know, say from the 60s onwards through to the 90s, you know, it was kind of politics to the left. But on social attitudes, Scotland looked fairly similar to the sort of English levels. Now, more recently, you do see Scottish politics and, you know, that's moved probably further to the left, but also Scottish social attitude surveys now, that does start to see a bit of a sort of change. And Scottish attitudes now do seem to be the left, actually not only of England, but also Wales, interestingly, on kind of issues relating to the role of the state. And it's very scientific, but my kind of own thought about this is I think that this is an instance where it's not been a bottom-up driven change, but a top-down driven change. In partly, and it relates to identity, come back to the point you were making, yeah. I think alongside the independence referendum, there's been a sort of shift in idea of what it means to be Scottish. And I think that a lot of people kind of associate Scottishness now with a slightly more progressive sort of approach to the role of the state. So I think that there has been a change in the, say, last 10 years in particular that has come from sort of elite attitudes kind of filtering down and also kind of views about the role of the state becoming equated to sort of more sort of more fundamental role views about basically identity and independence.
And Jonathan?
Yeah, I'm not on top of the polling data in Wales. we do have income tax powers in Wales. Those have not been used by Welsh Government. One of the things that we track through the Future Generations Act, though, is do you feel like you have a say in your community in how decisions are made in Wales? That's at 30%, which is low, but it has increased remarkably over from a very low base, you know, decades ago. So we are seeing sort of people feel a lot more kind of involved in decision making, which is a very positive thing. But I'll leave the tax varying answer to others.
And we've also been asked another Welsh question. Does the presence of things like the third sector scheme in Wales support closer relations with civil society organisations that support delivery against the social, economic and environmental priorities of devolved administrations? And should the UK government look to introduce something similar?
Yeah, and again, I don't want to steal the thunder of Mark Drakeford kind of on this, but, you know, new legislation has come in Wales around social partnership. And so placing the importance of involving trade unions, businesses and the third sector at the heart of decision making. When you listen to Welsh ministers talk about their policy agendas, it's this Team Wales approach that you always kind of see. And I think a lot of that is supported by this sense of these are our seven national goals. This is the mission that we're behind. That really brings in a sense of greater collaboration. One thing that I didn't mention yet is the private sector in Wales is not beholden to the Future Generations Act, but they're taking action on it. So I'm seeing Welsh businesses align their corporate strategies to the well-being goals, what they say to me is, now that the public sector and the third sector understand, have got their goals that they want, it's a lot easier for me as a business to come in behind it. So that sense of collaboration, I think, is greatly supported by having this sense of a national mission with the well-being goals.
Great. Unfortunately, that's all we have time for. We'll have to leave it there. But a big round of applause and a huge thank you to each of our panellists, to Katie, Jonathan and David. And I'll now hand back to Torsten for our next keynote. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this Resolution Foundation event. You can find more episodes and the latest living standards research on the Resolution Foundation website.